Part 7, Wearing Down. The holidays had passed, and with them the calm waters of our collective mental stream, untroubled by decisions. As we reached the white water of disturbing uncertainty, the strain on Swami Nikhilananda returned. All the medical opinion he could glean advised him to have the rest of Swami Madhavananda's treatment accomplished in the United States. And here he was trying to go ahead with the arrangements. But it was more than the senior Swami could bear to think of money again being spent on his body, when, as he so often said, he could eat, he could see. Why not wait a few years? Work of equal quality could be done in India by the doctors and dentists there. His host had other problems as well. It was Rosh Hashanah and the celebration of their new year by millions of New Yorkers had closed many businesses and offices. It had not been possible to get hold of the eye surgeon. More treatment meant hospitalization once again and further nursing. I was expected at my home base. Would Swami Ashokananda extend my leave? Once again, we settled in at 94th Street. It was the first Sunday of the new season, and Swami was using for his sermon some of the material he had prepared for the seminar. Over lunch, he brought up my name. He knew my lecture was the same stuff I gave at the seminar, rehashed, so he didn't put any money in the collection basket. Following his instructions, I never did. Just thank God, then, offered the older monk, that he didn't reach in and take anything out. Swami came up to me one day to say, "You know, I have been wondering for years why it is that the hair on my head remains black, but the hair of my beard has turned gray. But now I think I know the answer." Naturally, I was all ears to hear it. "It is because I have given so much exercise to my mouth and so little to my brain." Various Swamis and devotees were passing through the city now, visiting Swami Madhavananda. One was my own immediate superior, Swami Shraddhananda of Sacramento, who, though housed at the Vedanta Society across the park, would come to us for dinner each evening, and at ours otherwise as well. It was a fine opportunity for me to collect news from home, and I took it. About this time, there was, on Swami Nikhilananda's schedule, a trip to Philadelphia to lecture at the University of Pennsylvania on man and his environment, one of a series on the subject. On returning, he made some comments on the difficulty of finding precise equivalents for idiomatic expressions. It seems there was an elderly lady who had been one of the students of Swami Sarananda in his days in America. She visited India, and one of our Swamis there told her how Sri Ramakrishna had compared Swamiji and Swami Sarananda. In Bengali, it is, quote, "They are like the pot and its lid." But in his mouth, it came out like the cup and the saucer. This miffed the lady, who thought it a very unfair comparison for her guru, and never got over it. Swami Madhavananda, hearing the story, said that someone should have told her, "We always drink from the saucer, not the cup," and that would have placated her. someone had telephoned Swami Nikhilananda one morning, identifying himself as one of the staff of the Encyclopedia Americana. This man needed information about Ashwaghosha, author of some of the earliest of Sanskrit works. Swami asked if the encyclopedia was going to contain any entry on Ramakrishna or Vivekananda. The staff member thought well of the idea and invited him to lunch, finally asking him to write an entry on Vivekananda. "You know," he confided, "I have a special interest in that because of a family connection." The man went on to explain that there was a British general, Sir Charles Napier, who made history in the War of 1842 by capturing for his government the province of Sindh. It was done against the wishes of the East India Company. His fame lay in the telegram he sent to headquarters. Just one word in Latin, peccavi, that is, I have sinned. The general came to the United States to offer the Confederacy his services as a mercenary, but was too late. The war being nearly over, he found a wife in the form of a fashionable Southern belle and settled down. She was a prominent society lady who knew Swami Vivekananda and used to tell her family tales about him, stock stories in the household. She had taken him to plays, concerts, soirees. "And I," said the speaker, "am her grandson." He then tried to persuade the Swami to take a hand in writing all the entries on India in the encyclopedia. The Swami thought it would be too much for him, and he declined. One afternoon, Swami Nikhilananda led me with an air of mystery to a large pile of faded, ochre-colored cloths on a tray. "Can you recolor these for me? It is one of the first tasks given to a new brahmachari in India." I gulped, guessing at the yardage involved, but also cognizant that this might be one of the few things I could do for him in the way of personal service. My experimental methods of handling this, with two bathtubs and so on, proved disastrous. The hour was approaching for my taking Swami Madhavananda to the Vedanta Society for the evening. Close to panic, I ran to Swami Bhutananda's room and with a simulated calm put to him a question. "Swamiji, at what point can this dying process be halted and resumed the next day?" "Oh, it can't be at all," was his cheering answer. And he asked me to explain the problem. Soon both of us were washing and rinsing, stretching and dyeing in pails of water with alum and powdered rock dye until the bathroom was a thorough mess. The appointed hour now struck, and alas, I had to leave the Swami to finish the task. I had told him I would clean the bathroom, but on my return I found it all done. It was the largest of numerous debts which I could never repay him. Moffat had said it rightly. Incidents about the first disciples could not be prized out. They simply fell out as the spirit moved. We were told that Swami Adbhutananda, the disciple who was even more destitute of learning than the master, often had penetrating and remarkable illustrations to give about spiritual matters. After a talk which Latu Maharaj, as he was familiarly known, had given to a group of devotees, one of them asked him how the jiva, the individual soul, realizes The Bengali word used means to catch. Brahman. Latu Maharaj, after a moment, replied, "As a string of a sitar catches the tune played on the sitar, so does Jiva catch Brahman." In the preface of his translation of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, Swami Nikhilananda acknowledges Margaret Woodrow Wilson as one of those who edited it. They had formed a bond of warm friendship, the Swami and this eldest daughter of President Wilson. It was she, he told us, who had insisted on their retaining in places where he might have chosen to bury it, the literal equivalents of the Master's original expressions. For example, the phrase, "woman and gold." She felt he had a strong obligation to the world to keep this whole translation as literal as possible. In recent years, a whole new controversy about this has arisen over the exact equivalent of the word kamini. Woman does not meet the criteria. Miss Wilson relayed to Swami a family episode from her father's last days. One afternoon, long after Versailles and the subsequent struggle with Congress over his 14 points, her father was sitting on the lawn in an armchair, chin in hand, mulling over the turns of fortune. Margaret silently crept close to him and simply insinuated herself, undemandingly, into his presence. She had been his favorite. Wilson acknowledged her with a pat on her hand and soon spoke aloud without breaking his mood. "You know, Margaret, I have been thinking. All that world cooperation, it can come only from the bottom, from the ground up. That was my mistake. I tried to superimpose it all from the top." Returning to the matter of his guest's program, Swami Nikhilananda won the battle of the teeth and now bid fair to win that of the eyes as well. We were off to the dentist, and very soon Swami Madhavananda was shown the plastic mold of his own gums and palate, cradled carefully in the hands of one of the most expensive of the city's dentists, who was visibly moved with pride and ecstatic appreciation. "The eye makes its own beauty, doesn't it?" put in the office nurse mercifully, and surely more vedantically than she knew. The complicated denture was promised before Thanksgiving Day, and that seemed another mercy. It may have been in this reception room that we had a much longer wait than anticipated. Even Swami Madhavananda's vast patience was tested. I picked up a magazine and began to read. This drew from Swami Nikhilananda the comment nearest to a personal criticism that he ever gave me. Shaking his head, he said, "I see that you really are a Westerner after all. Faced with this wasted time, you must have something to read. You could have decided to do japa, and that would have put you in a different mold." November had crept up on us, and with it, winter weather. The decision about a cataract operation could be made only at month's end. It began to look as if we might all be together for a winter in New York. Diet was becoming a problem, for our patient had tired of the bland American flavors often doctored or denatured for his benefit, and for my cooking he had lost whatever graciousness of accommodation he may at first have had. One opinion was that this fastidiousness was a new sign of independence and therefore of improved health. Swami and Swami Bhutananda, both men of his part of India, pitched in to prepare curries and the like to tempt him. We even secured imported ingredients from out-of-the-way shops. Swami Nikhilananda was not unaccomplished in the kitchen. His stock of dishes was considerable, and he turned out favorite items with expertise. One day, after a spectacular culinary flop of mine, he put himself ever so gently in my shoes. "This Peace Corps business, not so easy, my boy. Don't you see how difficult it is to bridge disparate cultures? I had many years ahead of me in which to test it further for myself." Two of his reminiscences might be appropriate at this point. Guru Das Maharaj, the first Western Swami of the order, his formal name was Swami Atulananda, had related to him that when he was a newcomer in India, he went through trying days at Berur Math when homesickness nearly overcame him. He was feeling out of place, that he had not been accepted by the Indian community in which he had decided to place himself. On one such occasion, there was a large public celebration, and on a bench in the center of the gathering sat Raja Maharaj, Swami Brahmananda, and Swami Sharadananda. Suddenly Maharaj called to him, asking him to come and sit beside them on the bench. All the dark clouds of his mind were blown away, and he felt immensely gratified. The other incident took place during one of Swami Nikhilananda's routine walks in the streets along Central Park. He came upon, as he described it, a group of urchins. Puzzled, they studied him for a moment. "What nationality are you?" ventured one. "Indian," said Swami just as abruptly. "Indian? Then where are your feathers?" As the snow and ice appeared, Swami did all he could to persuade his brother to wear an overcoat, scarf, and mittens for his prescribed daily walk. The latter served as immovable object to this would-be irresistible force. He had already accepted the indignities of longis, wool shirts and stockings. More was superfluous, and that was that. The clash of wills reached such a point that the rest of us began to feel that if this winter passed without Swami Nikhilananda having a heart attack at seeing Swami Madhavananda go out without his overcoat, we would be fortunate indeed.